The Shire at this time had hardly any government. Families, for the most part, managed their own affairs. Growing food and eating it occupied most of their time. In other matters, they were, as a rule, generous and not greedy, but contented and moderate, so that estates, farms, workshops, and small trades tended to remain unchanged for generations. There had been no king for nearly 1,000 years, yet hobbits still said of wild folk and wicked things, such as trolls, that they had not heard of the king, for they attributed to the king of old all their essential laws, and usually they kept the laws of free will, because they were the rules, as they said, both ancient and just. It's episode 12 of The Grey Company, and on this episode, we thought it would be enlightening to address some of the common mistakes we as players make with our beloved game. As a cooperative as opposed to competitive game, there isn't much rule lawyering. Nobody is going to lose that big prize at the tournament over a misplayed card. And as such, there are also house rules and no real issue with friendly games bending the rules. But there are rules indeed, and today we will look at some of the more obvious mistakes that are made. Grab a pen, dust off your core rules, and settle in. Welcome, everyone, to the 12th episode of the Grey Company podcast. My name is Derek, and we are so glad to be back to a regular episode with our proud new Papa Hobbit, Ian. How is the parenting life treating you, sir?
Treating me pretty good. I'm a tired old Hobbit, but enjoying the new life so far. It's definitely a whole new experience, but it's good so far.
Excellent. It's parenting stretching you thin.
Like butter over too much bread.
Jeez.
Well, even if it's not quite as exciting, we'll check in with the rest of the company. Dan, how have you been doing?
Been doing well. I just, on Saturday, had a chance to do, we've got a semi-regular Austin group now meeting to play, and we had 7 people there, so it was really exciting. Our group has been growing. So, for anyone out there that doesn't already know this, I live in Austin, Texas. Please come by and meet me and play, and it's fun.
Well, it's all right.
Well, I think so. I mean, they don't have to, right?
Just kidding.
Speaking of fun, how are you, Matthew?
Oh, I'm good. I'll sort of echo Dan's comment. It's summertime, so I have a little bit more time to play the game. And I've mentioned a few times that I sort of lead the organized play group at my store. And I think we had 6 or 7 people yesterday. 4 new folks showed up either last weekend or this weekend. They all listened to the show, so I told them I'd give them a shout-out. So hi, Steve, Matt, Josh, and Ryan. You guys are now famous because you've been mentioned in the show.
Wow.
I will say it's a little bit weird. Josh came up to me and introduced himself and said, "Is it really weird that I recognize your voice?" And I was like, a little bit. So, but they're really good players. They've been a blast to play with, so it's super exciting. So if you live in Tempe or Phoenix, Arizona, feel free to let me know and we can add you to the group. But other than that, I ordered a copy of Ian's First Age set, so even though I have no clue who the characters are,
all right,
I'm excited to play it, and I haven't gotten it in the mail yet, but should get the new adventure pack this week. My store told me Tuesday or Wednesday, so I'm super excited.
Wow. Yeah, Metro Atlanta needs to step it up, because I've just got the same old group at my game shop, and they're just getting tired of me mentioning the podcast. Every time we play a new scenario, I'm like, guys, I run a podcast. I got this. And then they still don't use my decks, and they just laugh at me.
You know what's funny is, like, I think it was Steve, to give you another shout-out. He said, I thought it was so funny when you guys brought up this. I'm like, oh, dude, I have antioxidants when I'm recording. I don't really know who says what by the end of the show. But it's sort of funny because they know, like, what we say more than I do. I was like, oh, we talked about that on the show? So, I don't know. It's been really cool. They're a fun group.
That's great.
Yeah, the Bay Area where I'm at needs to step it up because there's no real regular groups. I'm actually looking to start one. Like, I know I shouldn't be taking on anything else right now, but I think everyone knows by now
Bring
that
Joaquin.
I'm kind of crazy and take on more than I should, but I'm looking to start a group. So if anyone out there is in the Bay Area looking to play regularly LOTR, you can email the Grey Company address and we can get that going. The good news, though, is I did convince a local store to host a fellowship event in October. So
that's good.
Looking forward to that.
You'll get that alternate Aragorn.
I will cradle it to sleep every night.
I'm gonna actually use whiteout and put it back to the what was it, 9th, right?
Yeah.
They had originally the picture and be like, yeah, this is the best hero ever.
You put a mustache on him.
That's funny.
It's his brother Baragorn. Yeah.
Well, we are just under a month away from Gen Con. We are totally excited, and we are finalizing some of our plans. We don't have an official event that you need to get tickets for, which is good because I've already got all my tickets. They came in the mail, and I definitely squealed in delight and hugged the mailman. That's not true. I didn't do that. Matthew, would you give us some of the details for our Ranger Con mini events Friday night?
So the four of us will be playing in the Fellowship event on Friday night at 6 p.m., and then after that, at about 8 p.m., we're encouraging all of you listeners out there who will be attending Gen Con to meet us at the FFG booth, and we will meander over to some sort of establishment that serves adult beverages, a.k.a. antioxidants, and we will have a merry old time. In addition to the antioxidants, the most exciting part will be we'll have some fun swag for you guys. Easter eggs, if you've been listening to the episodes, they will make sense to you what some of these things are. So I've seen them. They're super exciting. Ian's done a great job with it. So you have that to look forward to.
And their word on the street is that a certain Caleb Grace may be joining us as well. So you can bring either tomatoes to throw at him for all the cards that you hate, or lots of questions to ask him, or bring nothing and you can just hang out with them like a human being instead of a game designer. Whatever you should so choose. Okay, so we're all looking forward to Gen Con, but tonight the heart of the show is this. We are looking at common mistakes that we as players and other players that have posted on the FFG boards and so on make. And like I said at the top of the show, being a cooperative game, it's easy to kind of bend the rules a little bit or to just get into some bad habits or just not know the rules to begin with. So we're going to tackle a few of these, and let's start with setup.
12 Glorfindels.
12, you get your 12 Glorfindels out.
I think that's a common mistake.
Awesome.
For us anyway. But this is something that's easy to let slide. You know, mm-hmm. The way it's supposed to go is you set up your heroes, shuffle your deck, deal 6 cards, then set up the encounter deck, then you start the first turn with the resource phase, which would be the point at which you put your resources down and get your 7th card. I know a lot of times when I'm playing at the shop, I don't want to be that guy, and so I won't, you know, yell to everyone else at the table, just stop, just wait, stop drawing that 7th card, because it is a friendly game, but when it does need to be done properly, especially with some of these new quests that we've seen, which trigger off of card draw and things like that.
So two things to add. One is that the mulligan happens right after you draw those 6, so you still don't, you're not mulliganing based on the setup going, oh crap, I need to have a feint in hand because that guy's going to engage right away or whatever.
Right.
The other one is a recent errata also changes the way this stuff works, in that it used to be that if you got, like a good example would be, there's a lot of treacheries that add threat to the staging area until the end of the phase. Or you know, maybe even it would say until the end of the round, but if you got those during setup, it didn't matter, you know, in the case of the until end of phase ones, it didn't really do anything because the setup was its own phase essentially, and so they basically just whiffed. Now anything that's until end of round goes until, you know, it does include that first round even if it was revealed during setup, and then the first phase goes until the end of the resource phase, I want to say.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
So cards that basically would have whiffed before in setup, where you're like, oh, sweet, it doesn't do anything at all, a lot of those actually do something now.
Yeah, the resource thing is important because I can't remember the card titles off the top of my head, but there are cards, treacheries, that remove resources, and those can't do anything during setup because you haven't added your resources yet, and so that's also partly why it's an important distinction of the timing.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of little steps in there, but I think an easy way for players to remember is just the players do everything first, put out their heroes, handle their decks, draw the first 6 cards, and then you do all the encounter deck stuff, you know, look at the quest cards, set that up. So if you just kind of remember players stuff first, encounter deck second, then hopefully you'll remember the order everything goes in, and that will help you to remember.
Yeah. Another one, like more recent scenario where that is kind of interesting, is the To Catch an Orc one, where you're going to draw your 6. If you don't like them, you're going to mulligan. Then the setup is going to tell you to create that. I think it's like a 20-card orc deck each player makes. That's after you've drawn your six and potentially mulligan, then you're going to create the deck. So you don't do it before.
Yeah, that definitely comes into play. And, you know, one question sometimes newer players have is whether they can react to what's drawn in setup. You can technically, because you will have your cards, like we said, first, but you're not going to have any resources to pay for them. So you can't, like, a test of will, for example, a treachery during setup. You can, however, use Eleanor, so, because you don't need resources for that.
Yeah, and that is one real advantage to her, is that she's the only way to cancel something in setup. A treachery, that is.
I've learned something new already. but that also goes back to kind of the phases of the round, because obviously she wouldn't ready because it's the resource phase. The refresh phase doesn't happen until the very end of the round. And I think that's one that gets confused pretty easily. Is it the last step of the round or is it the beginning of the new turn?
Right, and that's an important one, I think. I always think of it as the first phase of the new turn, but it isn't, and so cards like Gandalf from the core set say leaves at the end of the round, so technically Gandalf refreshes before he bounces back to your hand if it was sneak attack or just goes to your discard pile, and so then you can use him for lots of other cards, maybe cards that reference an Astari that you could play during the refresh phase, a very good tale, you could exhaust him again to do some shenanigans there, so it is important to realize that refresh is the last phase of the round, so all of your refresh happens and you can do stuff with Gandalf and other cards that may or may not be leaving play.
There's something else important about refresh, and that is that the threat raise is the very first thing that happens during the refresh, and there's no player action window there. Right. So your threat's going up, then if you're still alive, you're doing stuff.
That's so like good. Aragorn, for example, the lore version.
Yep.
Would come into play then.
Yeah, so going from 49 to 50 and then hoping to trigger Aragorn, not going to work.
And it also speaks to the wording of peace and thought, because it says refresh action, exhaust two heroes to draw five cards. Those guys don't ready at the start of the next turn because they've already readied for the refresh phase before the beginning of that next turn, which is why we like to pair it with Fast Hitch, because it just pops the hobbits right back up.
Or in my case, I just like to not play it at all.
Yeah, so speaking of Lord Aragorn, kind of another thing that comes in with setup is your starting threat is based off those initial three heroes. So you do that, and then since you're doing quest setup after, say you're playing Escape from Dol Guldur, someone gets made a prisoner, but that doesn't change your starting threat because that's been set from the very beginning when you put those three heroes on the table. So no matter what happens to them, they get captured, they get blown up, whatever happens, your starting threat is based on whatever heroes you put on the table at the very beginning.
Right, yeah. Even if they die.
Yeah, unless there's some quest card that comes around or encounter card that says your starting threat changes, which is Shadow and Flame changes that. I think that's the only quest right now.
And the only hero that affects starting threat is Matthew's personal favorite, I know, is Merlond.
I was hoping someone wouldn't bring her up.
Hey, that's what I'm here for, Matt. I'm here to bring up the things you don't want to hear.
I know. Trolling of troll.
We should get Matthew a print, art print of Merlond so he can hang it up.
Now I want to do an alternate art version of Merlond and bring it for Matthew.
Well, if we're going to make alternate art, let's just have about alternate text.
Alternate text. Great. That's fantastic. One of the things that I'm noticing is kind of consistent in what we've gone over already is just that the details, a lot of the in terms of player action windows and the timing and stuff, the details in this game really matter. This is a very detail-oriented game. So it can seem like a subtle distinction, the whole thing about, like peace and thought, you exhaust it after you've readied, but all of these timing things end up really mattering, because if peace and thought was something that you could exhaust two ready heroes and then have them ready again immediately, that card would be amazing, whereas now it's much more of a risk reward kind of thing. Like, you really gotta, unless you have Fast Hitch or something like that, you really gotta be willing to pay the price.
Well, one big thing that can be confusing, Dan was talking about details, and one of the finer points of detail are the action windows, because you want to be able to play a card whenever you need it, but that's not always the case. And I'll start by talking about my favorite, which is that in the quest phase, during staging, there is no action window. But after the staging step, before quest resolution, there is an action window. And that's why a lot of people will wait to pitch to Eowyn, because you have that action window between staging and quest resolution, or triggering ally Faramir's ability to boost everybody's willpower before quest resolution. That's why a lot of times people will wait and see what happens before they tack on those extra few points of willpower just in case you need them. But this gets confusing, because while you don't have an action window per se, you can still, you know, kind of interrupt, which isn't in the rules, but you can interrupt and cancel when revealed effects using things like the aforementioned Eleanor and a test of will.
Yeah, and the key on that is the response.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Word in bold. If a card has response, it means that you, even if there's not an action window, you can always use that response if the appropriate trigger has happened.
Right.
Yeah, so it has to have the response. So kind of a key thing is, like, even if you had unexpected courage on Eleanor, you could cancel the first one, but you can't ready her in the middle of it and then cancel again, because the readying is an action. You can't do that during staging, so you got to make do with that first one that you cancel.
What are some of those other action windows that we might need to be aware of, or that sometimes slip under the radar?
Yeah, I knew one that I don't think I realized for a long time was that there's an action window between revealing the shadow card, but before you actually deal damage. And so things like, and I think I actually just sort of realized this or was aware of it recently, and that to me has made, and I can't think of the name of the card now, but Dunedain, whichever Dunedain signal boosts defense, if you, Dunedain Warning, you can pay that one resource and pass it on over, because that's an action if you need that extra point of defense. And I've never passed the Dunedain marks or warnings or any of those things in any games, and man, I am passing them left and right over the past couple of weeks. Those cards, I think, are incredibly undervalued, and it's really been a lifesaver in many instances. But you also could do some healing if you've got a card that's an action to heal a hero. If they're, you've just revealed the shadow, you know what's going to happen, but before you deal the damage, you can heal off some damage on that hero. So to me, it almost seems like a cheat that you can do it before you do resolve damage, but you can't do it in the middle of staging. But that's the way the game works, and that's, I think, a really important one to realize.
Yeah, there's an interesting distinction around the healing and the shadow card thing, is that this is why all shadow cards are not created equal, is that direct damage shadow cards to me are much more brutal than like plus attack. Because if a shadow card says, you know, attacking enemy gets plus 2 attack, well, what Matthew's talking about is absolutely true. You can discard a card to Protector of Lorien, you can spend a resource and move a Dunedain Warning, you can, you know, do shenanigans and exhaust a readied Arwen and give an extra bonus defense somewhere. There's all sorts of things you can do in that action window to boost the defense before the damage would actually resolve, whereas the shadow cards that say do 2 damage to the defending character, that's where you have to have a response.
Right.
You like boosting anything at that point, or even you couldn't even actually heal at that point is the other thing. Like, even if you've got your Warden of Healing ready to go, the damage happens immediately.
The other thing that I think is important to realize is certain actions have a qualifier in front of it. And so one that I'm thinking of off the top of my head is Feint, and that's a combat action. And so that means that it can only be played during the combat phase. So for example, if you're in staging and an enemy wants to make an attack against you and you're in the middle of the quest stage, you can't play Feint because you're not in the combat stage, and Feint's a combat action. I think a lot of times people just think, oh, Feint, it cancels an attack. I can play it whenever an attack is being made, and sadly, that's not the case.
I think one mistake I see a lot with newer players, and sometimes even players who have been playing for a while, is actually thinking that the action windows are more restricted than they are. Like, a lot of people consult the colored chart in the back of the rule book that has, you know, the little green sections and the red sections. And then, I know this from personal experience. When I first bought the game, this threw me off, too, because there's only a few spaces where it says players take actions or whatever. It says action windows available. But those aren't the only areas. Any area that's actually in green is... you can take an action during that time. So sometimes players get thrown off and think, you know, I can only take actions in like 3 different places in the turn, when really the only times when you can't take actions are kind of the ones we mentioned during staging, you know, right as the shadow card is being revealed. You can't, you know, just take it right in the middle of that. Basically, anytime something is being revealed from the encounter deck. And then there are a few where the order matters. Like we talked about the combat action thing right now. Also in the travel phase, like you travel before there's an action window. So you can't actually take action windows before you travel. Like as soon as the travel phase mm-hmm. hits, you travel. That's it.
I'm glad you brought up the rule book because I long ago stumbled across a very good quick reference over there on the internet, and it kind of takes what the rule book has and expands upon it a little bit, and it's very clear as to where actions are available, where responses are allowed, along with a bunch of other handy-dandy quick reference stuff. So it was put together by a guy named Kirk Bauer, and I will link that in the show notes. So I think that'll be pretty handy for anybody who's still coming to terms with all this action window craziness.
There's one other, in terms of the timing, one other thing to mention. In the diagram in the core set, anywhere where it's green, for multiplayer, that's a free-for-all for anyone right. to take actions. So as an example, during the, you know, we're all doing the resource phase. Everyone's drawn their card, added their resources. I can, right then in the window in that phase, I can say, hey, everyone go ahead and draw an extra card from,
Campfire Tales.
Campfire Tales, exactly. Like, even though it might be, you know, even though someone else might be first player, or, you know, say resource is a better example of that, but even though someone else might be doing their allies and attachments, that's still a general purpose window where I can play an event before they're done playing allies and attachments that lets them draw a card, and then maybe they draw another ally or attachment, and then they can then play that. Because they haven't, yeah. until a given player passes on their opportunity to play allies and attachments, other players can do things like trigger Glea Wine or Campfire Tales or Barovor to help them draw cards, and then they could still play those cards as part of that step.
And that can get a little tricky too, because like, let's say I pass, or, you know, my planning phase is done, Dan plays Errand Rider, and then Dan uses Errand Rider to pass me a resource. I can't go back and use that resource right. to pay for an ally or an attachment or something like that, as much as I really, really want to. I could use it to play an event, but not an ally or an attachment.
Yeah, it's kind of similar with the another key moment is committing characters to the quest. So same rule, yep. other players can take actions, but as far as committing your characters, that goes in player order and all your characters go at once. So this is kind of area where I know a lot of players get more fuzzy, because it's like, you know, we're doing math, like one player will commit and then people will go back and go like, wait a minute, we didn't commit enough, you know, which at the end of the day, I don't think it's the biggest, like, it depends on how much of a slave to the rules you are, but technically it's supposed to be in player order and all your characters committed at once. So that
we're only slaves to the lore on this show, so I think it's
yeah, not rule. Only slaves to lore and not rules. But that does have to do with Theodred's ability, so you know, yeah. you can't go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an important, I've been using him a lot lately, and that's an important one. Sometimes my buddies will be like, hey, can you pass me a resource? Oh, but I'm first player, so Theodred can only give it to himself or any of my heroes right. that are questing.
I was going to add that this also is why cards like Spirit Bofur are really good, is mm-hmm. Characters that let you add them into the, like, have an action that lets, you know, I think in his case it's a quest action, but you can, like, do that legally after the fact, go, oh crap, we didn't have enough, let me spend a Spirit resource and stick Bofur in, committed to the quest, because it specifically says on his card that that's what he does. So you could actually wait until after staging, before quest resolution, pop him in there and add his willpower to the quest. That's really what makes cards like that so powerful.
Yeah, and there's
or
also
you play
room
late
for
late adventurer.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was about to say. Late adventurer, which I think was that a coaster, Ian?
I can't remember what it.
Oh no, I just pulled it up. It's,
yeah,
it's
I think
a gem.
I did give it wow. a gem.
Gem,
yeah. Very surprising.
Wow, you must have been smoking some hobbit.
Too much of those hobbit pipes. I don't think I've actually used it in the deck since then. But no, I really like the idea of it. Like the idea that you could commit someone after. Like, how many times can we all think of where, you know, after the fact, you're like, if we would have just committed one more character, we could have just saved ourselves so much,
right.
you know, losing a time counter right. and yeah. essentially losing a quest or whatever it is. Whether or not I've actually played it is a whole nother matter, but, you know.
I was going to say earlier, as a side note, that's not quite related to actions, but it's similar, and it has to do with responses. And responses are always optional. So, for example, this weekend, I was one of the new buddies of mine, Ryan, hello. We were playing Escape from Dol Guldur, and he had never beaten the quest before, so that's why we were playing it. And we got stomped the first time, but we beat it the second time. But when it gets to the second stage, I believe, freeing the prisoner is a response. And so a lot of players think that you have to do responses. That one's whenever you place any amount of progress, you may free the prisoner, which brings the Nazgul into play. And so you don't have to do that right away. Legolas is another example where if you participate in an attack, you can place two progress on the current quest. And his is also a response. So lots of the new nightmare locations are really damaging. If you put progress on them, it might damage you back or what have you. So you don't have to choose to use his response if you don't want to. So responses are always optional, whereas actions can only happen in certain phases. So there's so many different sort of keywords, and sometimes you know, actions have the qualifier like combat action or refresh action, and it can be kind of confusing, but once you sort of, I think, get the gist of how and when they work, it becomes a little bit easier.
Yeah, and it's important when you point out responses on quest cards, that's where the real distinction there between response and force. They work,
right.
Timing-wise, they work the exact same way. Whenever the trigger happens, that's when the opportunity for that effect to go off. In the case of response, the first player is the ultimate decider of, or whoever controls the card that has the response, is the ultimate person to make that decision, whereas Forrest is always going to go off no matter what.
Correct, yeah.
Well, let's take a minute to talk about something that was very eye-opening for me. We had an email discussion going as we were preparing for the show, which led to some new light on the idea of attack opportunities. So this was news to me, but Dan, would you like to take a minute to kind of explain this whole idea of attack opportunities and how they work?
Yeah, and this is a phrase that I kind of coined myself. It's not actually in the rule book, and this is an example of one of the things that I will admit to me is very frustrating about FFG rule books in general, is that it's kind of like, so I took philosophy in college. It's kind of like one of those things where it's mystical, let's just say that. No one will ever sit you down and say, okay, this is the meaning of Zen, and if they do, they're probably just stoned. And it's very similar with
too much Hobbit.
Exactly. It's very similar with the way FFG rulebooks work, where there's certain little details that are never spelled out specifically, and you just kind of have to figure them out on your own. And attack opportunities are definitely one of those. And basically the way it works is every combat phase, each player gets a default attack opportunity, and that's going to go in player order. So first player is going to get their attack opportunity, the person, you know, going clockwise, the person to their left is going to get the next one, and the person to their left is going to get the next one, and then depending on however many players. Obviously in a solo game, you just as an individual have a single attack opportunity that is the one that you get by default. And the reason why I say default is that there are obviously card effects that will give you additional ones. Something like Quick Strike, that creates a new attack opportunity. Something like Hands Upon the Bow is another attack opportunity. Great U-Bow is another example. There's just Dune here has a unique twist to his attack opportunity where normally you would only have an attack opportunity where valid targets would be enemies that are engaged with you. Ranged is going to mean that it could be enemies engaged with other players, and in Dune here's case, it could be enemies that are in the staging area. So there's all these twists to kind of the default way that things work, but ranged gets really interesting because you can do something that a lot of players don't realize is legal, and that is you can have a ranged character like Legolas attack the same enemy multiple times in the same round legally without even something like Quick Strike. So using Legolas as an example, say I'm the second player, Matthew's the first player, I have Legolas and there's an enemy engaged with Matthew. Matthew's going to get his attack opportunity, and Legolas can participate in that attack because he has ranged. If I have some way to ready Legolas, like say Unexpected Courage, then when it comes to my attack opportunity, Legolas could also attack that enemy again because he's now attacking within that attack opportunity. So the limit on attacks is actually per attack opportunity. There is no hard and fast limit in this game of a given character can only attack a given enemy once. That's actually not true. And in addition to that, if cards will always break the attack opportunity rules. So if I have Quick Strike and I have Boromir, Tactics Boromir, I can use Quick Strike and attack that enemy immediately, and then when I get my normal attack opportunity, I could raise my threat by one, ready Boromir, attack that same enemy again. So yeah. Card effects are always going to let you break that rule, but range is one of those things that also lets you essentially break that rule in the example that I gave.
On the flip side, though, you couldn't ready Boromir twice with his ability to attack the same enemy.
Nope, because that was your default attack opportunity and you've already used it.
Right, but yeah, this ranged one, I actually emailed Caleb, I think, last week, perhaps the week before, because this was a question on BGG, and I was like, wait a minute, I've never played range this way. I just had in my head, I think as a lot of people do, that you can only ever attack an enemy once with the same character, whether it's your turn or it's someone else's turn and you've got ranged. And I mean, I don't want to say I was blown away by the ruling. I suppose I was. I don't know if it would affect too many of my games, but I certainly thought it was interesting. And in a way, it almost seems like cheating. It'd be an easier, simpler rule if each character could only attack an enemy once, and that's just how it worked. But certainly it makes ranged characters, I think, even better than I already thought that they were.
Yeah, definitely multiplayer ranged is one of those things now. I look around the table before a game, and I see how much range is out there, and I have that as like a kind of a gauge of how the game's going to go.
Yeah.
There's one other thing that I'll add, and this is a really weird rules minutia, but it does relate to this attack opportunity stuff, is there's more and more enemies these days with immune to player card effects, and Quick Strike, the way it's worded, it actually just essentially creates a new attack opportunity, only you only get to do it with a single character. So you couldn't gang up on a given enemy using Quick Strike. But because of the way it's worded, you don't actually target that enemy. You're really just picking your own character and getting that extra attack, which means that you can legally use Quick Strike to attack an enemy that is immune to player card effects, because Quick Strike is not targeting that enemy, it's targeting your character. On the other hand, Hands Upon the Bow doesn't work that way. It's creating an attack opportunity, but it's creating one that you normally would not have because it's letting you attack into the staging area. And because of that, and because you're essentially choosing the enemy in the staging area to attack, you cannot use Quick Strike to... I'm sorry, you cannot use Hands Upon the Bow to attack an enemy in the staging area that is immune to player card effects.
Yeah, that's a murky one that people just go round and round and round in the forums, and I'm not so sure that the logic is consistent, but I buy it and I just have to accept it. Quick Strike's also a card I never use, so it doesn't really matter to me, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. This is one of those ones where that's Caleb's ruling, and I get it, and I do understand the reasoning behind it, but it's like, it goes back to my comment about philosophy. Like, if you asked me that without Caleb's ruling on it, I could easily go either way on that.
The whole immunity thing is so tough for, I think, especially players who are new to the game, and especially players who are new to these kind of card games in general, and maybe we'll get back to that later, but just the whole immunity issue brings up so many problems as far as what can I actually play on that enemy or that character, and what can't I play on them.
Yeah, I mean, again, the default thing that I always say to new players, all right, what's going to make the game harder? Odds are that's probably the safest assumption to make is play the more difficult way.
Yeah, that is a very good rule of thumb for this game.
So many players like to twist cards and make them do things that's clearly not the intent, or even sometimes less clearly not the intent, but, you know, coming up with all sorts of ways to break things. And to me, if a card's immune to player card effects, even if I'm wrong, I'm not going to be able to use any card effect to do anything. It's just normal actions. Attacking isn't a card effect. It's a framework, a piece of framework of the game where you can declare attack. I don't need a card to do it. And so that's sort of always my rule of thumb.
It's a good rule. And when you think about it, this game being cooperative where you're playing against the deck, even if it's solo, you're still just playing, it's a solitaire game at that point. The encounter deck really does need to be given the benefit of the doubt, because you're going to deck build, you're going to strategize against it. So in those 50-50 cases that you're talking about, that rule of thumb is an excellent one, is that you shouldn't default to like, oh, benefit the player. Well, then the game is going to become too easy at that point.
You know? Right. The encounter deck can't change and grow and react to us, whereas we can.
Until Skynet comes out, and then we're all in serious trouble.
So speaking of that, always defaulting to the most difficult options, the one that I still struggle with the most, and the fact hasn't made it any clearer for me, is what about treacheries that give an option? And so I was playing some quests this weekend, and it said the players must do, and then it lists two different things. And I know in the forums we've gone round and round about this. And so again, I was, and then one of the options was something we could never resolve because it never affected us. And the other one was something we could do, which was damage some characters. And so we always chose the option that would have an effect. And so the first one, we can't fulfill it because I don't remember exactly what it was, so it didn't ever apply to our board state. So I said, I can never remember what we're supposed to do when we're given an option, so let's just pick the one we know we can do to make it a little bit harder for ourselves. But that's one I never actually know how it works.
So I have seen the clarification from Caleb on this, and it's actually kind of weird because there's older cards that don't follow the template, so there are exceptions to this. But the general rule is, for all the new cards, they're specifically templating it, do X crazy thing that you may or may not be able to do, or do Y. And they're specifically templating it that way so that if you can't do X, you have to do Y.
So you have to choose something that would affect the game state.
Yes, and this is with all the new cards, because there are some weird exceptions, and like I want to say it's like Corset or Shadows of Mirkwood stuff, where they're worded slightly differently, and they're actually, those cards are specifically in the FAQ where you can essentially choose to have it fizzle, and that's exactly why they're wording the new cards with the template that they are, with the or thing, is that you basically, it's saying like, do this crazy thing if you're able to do it, and I don't think it actually always says if able, but the idea is, if you're able to do this thing, do it. Otherwise, you have to do this other one. And the second one, like in your example of, you obviously have heroes in play or you're out of the game, so dealing damage to characters is always going to be an option.
Right.
Yeah, I think, you know, ideally there would have been a little bit different way to phrase this whole thing to make it clear, like, choose one and, you know, whatever it may be, but I guess the one positive step Caleb and Matt have taken is just, like, we're going to stick to these templates, and they have since, you know, they kind of established that and took over, because in the past it was a free-for-all, and they've phrased them, like, a billion different ways, and you don't know what applies where, but at least hopefully now in the future, it is still very confusing, but at least we can look at the kind of wording and figure out which one of those two situations we're facing.
I almost wish it would say, you know, just if the options are discard an attachment you control or damage a hero. I almost would say discard an attachment you control. If you cannot discard an attachment, then damage a hero. Now, for some things, it might make the card text too long, but then in that case, to me, it's perfectly clear that if you cannot do the first one, there's no attachments for you to discard, you cannot choose that option, you mustn't. And I don't think it actually makes it that much longer. But
you'll see a similar thing in the way other treacheries are worded these days, where it used to be in the core set you would have ones like Evil Storm, where if you're threat 35 or higher, do one damage to all your characters. If not, it does nothing. Well, every card like Evil Storm that's been printed in the last like couple cycles will say, like, each player that has threat 35 or higher does one damage to all the characters they control. If this treachery dealt no damage, it gains surge.
Right.
Like, they specifically build that into the card, so it's really clear, and it goes back to, like, honestly, Matthew's golden rule is really one to go, you know, to just in general go by, is that if there's a card that would totally fizzle and do absolutely nothing in the case of a treachery, it should surge. And if there's a card that gives you a choice and one of them is going to totally fizzle, it should do the other. Because the idea of revealing a card from the encounter deck, especially as the card pool gets bigger and we have these really powerful decks, there's just no way that the encounter deck can afford to have a card that does absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I know people kind of have different feelings as far as whether they prefer cards to be kept as short text as possible or avoid the long text, which I think is generally good. But for me, I kind of prefer, you know, even if they have to go a little longer, that it's clear. Like, I'd rather have card text that's a little bit longer and players have to refer to other things less, you know, they don't have to refer to the FAQ as much. You know, because, yeah, maybe they have to read a little bit longer on each card, but honestly, when you play this game, you read the cards once, and when you keep playing the scenario, you just see the title, and you kind of remember what it does, or you can kind of skip over it quickly, so.
Yeah, you kind of have to. If you were to play this game, like,
right,
every last card, every time, it would just
don't forget
forever.
The flavor text. Read it every time. Mm,
delicious. And kind of along those same lines is something that I feel like we've just now kind of come to a definitive conclusion on, which is those treacheries or shadow effects that call for additional attacks. For a long time, it wasn't clear whether or not the enemy gets a fresh shadow card when they do the other attack, but they do. Unless it specifically says do not deal an additional shadow card, the attacking enemy does get another shadow card.
Right. Again, that's one that I couldn't remember for a long time, and I always defaulted to, well, what makes it harder? What makes it more difficult? What makes it more difficult is giving it a shadow card.
Yep.
And that's what I would usually do.
Yeah, no, it is confusing, because sometimes the card would say deal it another shadow card, but...
Right. Yeah.
It's going to be my new bumper sticker, Matthew's Golden Rule.
And that's the thing. Some cards do spell things out, and other cards don't.
Yeah.
I just had an example, and it just totally... someone on BGG brought it up, and it has to do with a nightmare card from Journey to Rosgobel, where the When Revealed effect doesn't say including Will-Yador, but the shadow effects does specify including Will-Yador. It has to do with the whichever character has the most damage, you do something to it. And so he's like, well, why does it mention including Will-Yador on the same card in the shadow, but not in its normal When Revealed effect? Which
really
is sort
ambiguous.
Of weird and very inconsistent. But it's just one of those things that, you know, everyone's human and things slip through, but Will-Yador is a character. So just because it specifies it in one place doesn't mean that it doesn't apply in other instances, even
right.
if it's the same card.
Yeah, objective allies are still characters for all intents and purposes in the game. So really, like, even though that one seems ambiguous, it's actually, it works the same in either case.
Right.
The only way it would work otherwise is if it actually said, do not include Will-Yador in this
Correct.
Consideration.
Yeah, when I was designing the first age stuff, I tried to keep to existing, wording and templates as much as possible. And then kind of what you discover as you go through the existing card pool is how much inconsistency there is. So I'd be left saying, like, okay, which one of these three different ways to say this thing do I follow? But what I always try to remind people, I think, who maybe aren't aware of the history of this game, is that it has changed design hands a few different times. So of course you're gonna get differences in how they word things. And I think Caleb and Matt specifically have tried to say, rather than follow this old wording sometimes that we don't really like, we're gonna create some new wording that maybe makes more sense and just stick to it, which is fair, I think.
Right. And additionally, this is the first game of its kind, really. And so I often think of the first year or so of this game as sort of its trial period. They were figuring it out. And counter decks didn't work. They didn't synergize as well as they do now. Card wording was much more unclear. Some cards are probably too powerful and should have restrictions. And I think they had to figure out how to make a cooperative game that would still be engaging and fresh and fun. Because there were certainly cooperative board games, but a card game like this was different. And I think it just took them a little bit of time to figure out the best way, the clearest way to word things, the best way to design cards. And I think we're finally in a period where most things make sense and are pretty clear what their effects should be.
Yeah, the card templating is getting better. I agree, though, with the earlier comment about the nightmare cards, is the templating on nightmare seems to be the most inconsistent, I would say. Or certainly it doesn't always match up with the templating on all the non-nightmare stuff, so it can be a little bit confusing when you go to read those. But it goes back to to Matthew's golden rule, which is that especially certainly with nightmare, that whatever the interpretation that would be the most heinous, that's the one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sauron does not easily show mercy.
No, he does not.
Well, let's jump to Dan's favorite, which is the resolution order of revealed and counter cards.
Yeah, I'm going to just
you
run
get on your
really,
soapbox
really,
here, or should we just
really,
kind of preempt
no,
it?
No, see, that's the thing. I don't want to get on my soapbox. I'm going to run through this very quickly. There's actually a whole discussion on FFG. The title of the thread is Thror's Key versus Surge. And I will mention that question because it's worth bringing up here, which is someone asked, Thror's Key is the spirit attachment where you can, as a response, when a location comes into play, you can stick it on that location to blank the text. And they asked the very good question of, well, if that location has surge, what happens? Because obviously, by the time Thror's Key is attached, it's going to blank out that surge keyword. The real question is, does it attach in time to cancel the surge, or has the surge already happened? And this gets into the whole discussion of, okay, what is the timing of when you reveal an encounter card? And so just kind of going from the top and going through the order of how it works when you reveal an encounter card, the very first thing that happens when you do when you reveal an encounter card is there's a small set of effects that are while a card is revealed, something happens. The best example of this is Thalin. So while an enemy is revealed, Thalin immediately does a damage to them. So if it's an Eastern Crows and they have Surge or they could have whatever when revealed or whatever other effect, he immediately damages that crow before keywords are checked, before when revealed, before anything else, and that crow dies. So in the case of Thalin questing and Eastern Crows, they're not going to Surge because his ability trumps essentially everything else. The very next thing that you check on a card, though, assuming they didn't die to Thalin, is you check keywords. So Surge, Doomed, Ambush, there's a bunch of other keywords in the game. A lot of them don't really matter right when a card is revealed, like take the Huorns in one of the latest scenarios, they have Hinder. That doesn't do anything at all at that point, so it doesn't really matter that you're checking that keyword at that point, but that's when you're actually looking for all the keywords to trigger. So something like Doomed would trigger immediately. Like, a doomed enemy that has more than one hit point, in Thalin's questing, Thalin's not going to kill him. The doomed is going to go off right then. Every player is going to raise their threat immediately. Now, this is where we get into the weird stuff with Surge, though, is even though we're looking at all the keywords right now, Surge is one of those keywords that would trigger. Surge is the oddball where it does not actually resolve immediately. And the reason for that makes sense when you step through the ordering of everything is that you need to still do the when revealed on the card.
Yeah.
So a card that has a Surge keyword and a when revealed effect, the Surge is basically going to go off first, and it's going to say, okay, once you do the when revealed, I'm going to Surge. And the reason for that weird ordering is so that you can have the when revealed effect completely resolve and you don't end up with a bunch of these cards surging and being in this limbo state. So essentially it's, you do the while revealed for Thalin, you check the Surge and the Doomed, you do the when revealed effect. If the card had Surge, it would then Surge. Then, at the very end of that whole process, if it is a location or an enemy, you put it into play.
So if you were to cancel a when revealed treachery with a test of will, let's say, but it's Surged, you cancel the when revealed, but you still have to Surge or Doomed or whatever else?
Yeah. The only exception, and this is another one that gets weird, is that there are some when revealeds that say this card surges, right? Or the ones we talked about earlier. Like when revealed, do one damage to all exhausted characters. If this does no damage, this card surges.
But if it has the keyword, that still has to happen even though you canceled the when revealed.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, but... Yeah. But when revealed can actually give it keywords, like in all the sure. new cards that say, like, if yada yada doesn't happen, this card gains Surge. The when revealed effect was giving it the keyword, so if you cancel the when revealed, it doesn't ever get Surge.
And I would assume a lot of people make the mistake that if you're using a test of will to cancel it, you're canceling the whole card. But you're really not.
No, it's... Which, I guess one good aspect is it opens up some design space, which is... You know, when revealeds get canceled, but now there's room for surges being dealt with, like we saw with Minas Tirith Lamprey, and, you know, things that can interact with Doom. So I guess one positive part of that, of separating them out, is you kind of give a reason for other cards to exist. Just one small note before I forget is one mistake that could potentially happen is that these keywords, the actual keywords, only trigger... when the card is revealed from the encounter deck. So if it's, you know, revealed from discard pile, revealed from somewhere else, those keywords actually do not trigger. It's been kind of something that's been debated. I don't know if there's ever been official ruling on specific cases this comes up. Like, I think it's a Suspicious Crow. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong. That brings something back from the discard pile. But according to the rules, according to the FAQ, these keywords only trigger when it's revealed from the actual encounter deck.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. So to wrap this whole topic up, because it's really, we could go into, you know, hours and hours of minutia, rules minutia, but the answer to the Thrower's Key question is, Thor's key does not stop the surge, because if, as you notice, the very last thing in the whole process is the location gets added, and that's actually what you're responding to with Thor's key.
Right.
So all the other stuff on the location has already happened by the time the location is in play.
Right. And I think the other key is Thor's. The other key of Thor's key is it says after. I believe it's after a location is, and
yes.
Kind of, you know, if you're getting used to this game, the keywords to look at in kind of responses and forced is after versus when. So after is like after everything that's involved in that particular thing triggers, then this response takes effect. If it's when, then it's simultaneous. Although that,
yeah, or
right,
while. Like that, like while is why Thalon is so awesome. Like that's that one word is probably the most important thing.
And I think expecting mischief is the oddball. I think it says as it's revealed, but it plays out the same as WoW. So expecting mischief is the same as Thalon, basically.
Well, there are several more common mistakes that we had thought to talk about, but we are coming up short on time. So I guess we'll have to do a follow-up episode, or you could track us down on social media and ask us any questions that you may have, and hopefully we can answer them with expertise and authority. But before we go, we are going to take a minute to talk about potential improvements we would like to see to the game or to Errata. So this will be us kind of taking the design reins for a second and thinking through some improvements that might either make the game more clear or just in general more playable.
So after this discussion, I almost want to say the biggest improvement is going back and rewriting the rule book, but I don't think that's going to happen. So the one that I had come up with in our show notes was a rule that I would say every CCG or card game I've ever played, I believe, has this rule. And there might be some that don't, or certainly games I've never played, but I think the hand size should be limited to 7. So many of the broken decks and a lot of the errata that this game has had is because of those sorts of players who, you know, are drawing their whole deck in one or two turns, and then they have sort of infinite responses to whatever the encounter deck could do, and so those combinations, or at least some of them, have been nerfed. So I would like to see there just being a hand size. I think it would solve a lot of potential future problems with card draw. It makes your choices more important. It gives us a limitation against the encounter deck without having the encounter deck having to get more and more powerful, because we can't have every potential option in our deck, in our hand, to respond to the encounter deck. So I'd like to see a hand limit. It doesn't have to be 7 necessarily, but I believe most card games have it at 7.
To kind of piggyback on that, one of the complaints I get from people who enjoy this game but don't collect it, maybe don't play it as consistently as I do, they don't like the fact that you only draw one card each turn. And there are pretty limited card drawing abilities in this game. You've got Foe Hammer and Tactics and Ancient Mathem and Spirit and Campfire Tales.
And
that,
all of the Lore Sphere.
And then all the Lore Sphere. The Lore Sphere is bananas. but for everybody else, they're kind of left in the dust. So you don't see that many cards. So I think it would be pretty interesting if you were allowed to draw two cards each round. The Cthulhu LCG does this. And I think that could be balanced if there was a hand limit, kind of like Matthew was saying. So drawing two cards would allow you to see more of your deck, which might make it, a little more fun for some players.
I think Game of Thrones does that as well, if I remember. But again, most games I've played, they're all just one.
Game of Thrones has a very interesting combination of actually both of your guys' ideas, which is you draw two per turn, but there is an absolute cap on, and a given player can only draw 5 total on their turn. So, like, you can use card effects to draw 3 more, and then even if a card says draw 6 cards, it doesn't matter. You're going to draw up to the cap and stop.
Right. A lot of games, if your deck is empty, you instantly lose. Magic, of course, being one. The original Star Wars game by Decipher was another. I don't know if I would go so far as to say that, but certainly I think there needs to be some sort of limit to drawing or hand size.
I have a feeling that we're too late in the game to do that.
Oh, absolutely.
When you
look
at the... Well, not just because of how long it's been out, but because of a particular archetype, which is the Dwarven Digger archetype, is going to be all about taking your deck and sticking it in your discard pile. And I'm all for the fun decks that's going to lead to, but that really, if we suddenly change the game, retcon it and say, oh, when you run out of cards, you lose, then that entire archetype basically just becomes counterproductive.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even recommend that, but I certainly would be all for limiting hand size.
Yeah, I'm with you guys on actually both of those ideas. I think it would be really interesting to go with, even as a house rule, to go with Derek's and say you can draw two a turn, but then you cannot draw cards through card effects.
Yeah, I've become more and more a fan of the draw limit. I'm kind of torn on the hand size limit, but definitely I think there should be a limit on how many you draw per turn. I don't know if we're ever going to see a big errata to the rules of the game, so I think kind of the compromise for me in that realm is just that they be really careful in all future cards that, like, Legacy of Durin should have never been unlimited, in my opinion. That should have been limit once per round. And I think anytime you're ever designing a card draw effect, just make it limit once per round and you'll be safe. So there's no need to be drawing crazy amounts if you're already drawing on top of what you get. So if they just limit it in the future, at least we'll have some damage control.
Yeah, the problem is the encounter deck can't keep up. It doesn't get to reveal extra cards just because it wants to, unless they, of course, add Surge or some of these fetch effects. But it's individual quests. So, for example, we could have a quest in the future that says if your deck reaches zero, you die. Or a quest could say you can't draw more than three cards a turn. Or, you know, quests can
Steward's
fix these
Fear,
things.
Steward's Fear has a plot that if your deck runs out, you lose.
Oh, that's right. I thought we had that. But, you know, and so I think this cycle of quests, I think one of the spoiler articles or preview articles had said this is the hand size stuff is a response to the way a lot of players are playing. So we can have quests or cycles address these issues, which I think is great, but it's only for a quest or only for a cycle, or I'd rather see it almost a more sort of semi-permanent thing.
The one that I would add, one thing that I would change, and it's actually come from some of my more recent multiplayer experiences, because in the Austin group we've been doing a lot of like 3 and 4 player games, and whereas before it was I played a lot more solo and then 2 player with my wife, is the most obvious way the game changes when you go from 1 and 2 to 3 and 4 players is locations. And that to me is where I really feel like I'm pretty good at suspending my disbelief and kind of, you know, you just kind of like abstract away why things are the way they are, but there's something really absurd about playing a 4-player game and having 13 locations in the staging area and having, here's the worst part of it, having everyone with heroes that are decked out and ready to go and you want to fight in this battle and you all die because you all hit 50 threat because there's 47 threat in the staging area through all these random locations, and it'll be like 2 and 3 copies of the same location with Surge on it. And to me, that's, like, to be quite honest, that's kind of a fundamental breakdown where I have a sneaking suspicion that a lot of these scenarios just were never really intended or never really heavily tested with 3 or 4 players. I really feel like the sweet spot for the game is 2 players. Solo, you don't really see the synergy of the encounter deck. And whereas 2 players, you know, you're getting at least 2 cards a turn, a lot of times 3 with Surge, and so you start to see, like, combinations, but you usually don't see more than 1 or 2 additional locations a turn, and so you can, like this is the whole bottleneck, right, is in a 4-player game, if, because of Surge and because of these effects that make you go search for stuff, if we're revealing 4 new locations, 3 or 4 new locations a round in a 4-player game, and we can only travel to 1 of them, it doesn't, our decks could be amazing, like, we are going to lose because... And the worst part to me is not the loss, it's the negative play experience where everyone's ready to go, they want to fight, they want to use the cards in their hand, they want to use the Test of Will to cancel the bad treachery, or have their Eleanor help out, or like whatever it is that they're bringing to the table to help out, and when location lock, like a lot of those locations, they don't even do anything. They just sit there and have all these quest points so that you can't get rid of them with Northern Tracker, and they have all this threat, so everyone dies. And to me, that's kind of a crappy way to end the game. It's just like, oh, well, we couldn't get through these 15 locations, so we all lose. Sorry, guys. And some scenarios are a lot worse than others. I mean, we played on Friday, we played Steward's Fear, which I had played solo, 2 and even 3 player, and it's a great scenario, but then you play it 4, and it's awful, because you're basically revealing 3, like, it's almost guaranteed you're revealing 3 locations around.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if that one bothers me as much. I certainly haven't had... let me say that it sucks to lose by location lock, and we've all had it from at one point or another, but I would maybe counter-argue that if it's a consistent problem, it's that your heroes or your decks are decked out, so to speak, for the wrong thing. If you're playing a 4-player game, you need to know that location management and I've said on the show before that I think the location slash travel part of the game is the most boring and the least exciting, which is why quests like the Hills of Emmon Weal or even the Steward's Fear for me fall really flat, because it's those quests focus on the most boring aspect of the game. But with that said, I think then you have to have location control. The little Rohan horse that you can pop to do two progress, you're going to need secret paths, or there's lots of cards that help you deal with locations. And so if in a four-player game, you might be prepared for everything else, but this is a third of the game. You got to deal with treacheries, you got to deal with enemies, and the other third of the encounter deck is locations. So to me, I almost wonder if that's more of a deck design problem than a problem of the game.
So I totally hear your counter argument, but here's my whole thing, and here's why, especially going to when there's a lot of new players or new-ish players, that I wouldn't want to go to them and be like, okay, you're going to put Asphaloth in your deck, you're going to put Northern Tracker in your deck, is that here's the problem, and it speaks to exactly what you said, Matthew, and that is that we could do that, and we would win, and it would be freaking boring. Yeah. Like, at that point, when you get, and I've seen it in multiplayer, where you have, like, I've had a game where there was three Northern Trackers in play, you know, multiple players, not like one player had all of them, but where you're basically, every location that comes into play, it's staying for a round, and then the next round, when they all quest, it just goes away. And the game is so incredibly boring at that point that, like, I like that there are locations, and I like that travel is, and especially when there's new travel effects that you really have to think about, like, do I want to, you know, bite the bullet and do the, and you know, make whatever sacrifice needs to be made to do that travel effect. Like, that's a good thing, and that's a, and thematically, it's part of, you know, what Tolkien stories are about, is going to different places and you know, experiencing different things. So I get why locations are in the game. It just, the scale to me is broken there.
Yeah, I can totally see that. I just know this weekend I was praying. I pray for locations when things aren't going well. Because, like, oh, I cannot handle another enemy this turn. And every treachery, my God, makes me want to just run for the hills screaming. And so locations to me are almost always a break. Because, all right, you might be adding threat, but I don't have to deal with you right away. And if you're in a bad state, God, that's what I want to do. So in a four-player game, if you limited it to only one location per turn or two, or I don't know what you would do, but God, that means you're revealing even nastier, potentially nastier stuff. So, I mean, I totally see your point. Locations to me are the most boring part of the game, and I'm not sure how you make them better. We had the one episode where we talked about what could we do to make the game better, and I didn't have a solution for locations, but I don't know how you fix it, you know, but I see your point.
Yeah. And this is not, and I will say right out, this is like I'm talking about a house rule here, so any listener that doesn't like house rules or doesn't agree with this, it's take it with a grain of salt. But I think, honestly, in our 3- and 4-player games at the Austin meetup, I'm going to probably introduce a house rule where we basically have an Eleanor on, like, once per round, a built-in Eleanor on locations where we can just say, discard it and reveal a new card. And maybe it's a location and maybe it doesn't do you any good, but just, you know, it's really either do exactly what you're talking about, Matthew, which is just have everyone deck build for that, and then the game to me, honestly, gets really boring when you have a lot of location control, because you're basically playing 2/3 of the game,
right?
And you can really circumvent, like, a vast majority of the challenges that locations even present. Right. And, like, the fun part really is combat. And is and questing, right? Like, figuring out how much to send on questing, doing the different effects during the quest phase to make sure you quest as much as you need to. That's a really interesting, challenging part of the game. And then combat is a really interesting, challenging part of the game. Travel, I agree with you. It's the weak link here. So the idea that we're all going to deck build for that is,
and I think the problem comes from player card design. There's lots of fun ways to deal with combat. There's lots of interesting ways, late adventurer for one, to deal with questing. We don't have interesting ways to deal with locations. It's either Asphaloth or Snowborn Scout, which just pop progress on it, or Legolas, or it's secret paths to negate the threat. Why don't we get an ally that says, you can pop the ally or something, or maybe the ally just costs a lot, you can have two active locations at a time.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Or if you explore, the active location through Legolas or something, you can instantly add another one. Like, the Westfold Traveler is such a great card, but you can't switch if there isn't one that's already active. So we need an ally that will let us make something active after the travel phase. Or after
this? How's about a hero that their ability is you can now have two active locations?
Well, I don't know if you'd always want that, but
well,
certainly
you wouldn't always run that hero.
That's kind of along the lines of what I was thinking. Is I think the only way it's actually going to get addressed is through player cards. So maybe something that lets you travel to two locations, whether it's an attachment or something. I don't know. That would have to be tested to see how well it works. But
certainly. Yeah, we just need more creative ways to deal with them, like we have in the other.
But you know, we have seen like some cool stuff. Like even though it's not necessarily dealing with locations, but even if it's just interacting with it more, like Elfstone, and you know, even going back to Ancient Mathem, and just giving us more reasons to think about these locations and be interested in them. You know, we could have like hideouts and all kinds of stuff we could attach to these locations that might make it more interesting, at least.
Yeah,
it's a largely unexplored option that I think will hopefully, it'll be one more avenue that the game designers can take when the time comes. Yep. So,
I think people would be disappointed if the hero interacted with locations, because again, for most of us, it's the least fun part. But again, we have such a large hero pool now. I think it would be interesting to have a hero interact with locations, because correct me if I'm wrong, we don't have one.
Not that I can think of.
At least not yet.
Not directly, no, yeah.
Yeah.
Ian, what improvements do you think the game could use?
Well, I was a little bit of an overachiever and thought of three, but I'll just shorten it to one, because I already mentioned one earlier, which is the draw limit. This one is completely impractical just because of how far along we are in the life of the game, but it's something I thought about recently. Because I bought a game recently called Galactic Strike Force. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. Haven't had a chance to play it at all because of, you know, becoming a dad and all that. But one of the things I did like about it is because, you know, that we talk about Lord of the Rings. That game has a ton to kind of process and think about in each turn, because there's so many cards and they all have effects that trigger in different phases. But one thing I like that they did is they printed in like different color letters, big letters that say, like, I can't even remember the phases of the game, but say if there was a refresh phase action, there would be like a big red R on the card. So the reason I like that is because you can quickly look at it. You don't have to read the text. You don't have to read what it says, because one of the common things I think that players make mistakes is just forgetting to trigger an action, right, on a card, because the only alternative is to read through each card every single phase. And so I like that this game, there's a big letter there. You can quickly scan the board, see, okay, there's an A, I'm in the A phase. That means there's an action that needs to be triggered there. Obviously, like I said, that's kind of impractical for a game now, because they're not going to go back and put all these letters in. But I just wish there was something like that to help players, especially as now we're getting more and more effects that trigger with time counters and this and that. If there were handy visual ways to, you know, key in players that these things need to be triggered at a certain time.
Yeah, there might be a DIY alternative that we could figure out. Any closing thoughts on common mistakes before we wrap this one up?
I mean, certainly it's a complicated game, and I think you have to go slowly. Even advanced players, or people who have been playing a while, I don't know if I could call myself advanced, I still make mistakes, I still am confused about things. I just learned about the range thing by emailing Caleb the other day, because I thought the people on BGG were perhaps not correct, and then it turned out that I have been playing the game wrong forever. And I think, again, a lot of it stems from the rule books being unclear, and as much as I love FFG and their games, they've got great game designs, the components are always very nice. Their rule books consistently across all things, I think the number one complaint is they aren't as clear as they need to be, and FAQs come out almost the week games first drop. And so again, Warhammer Conquest, I wouldn't be shocked. The rule book's probably already printed. They're getting packed to sell it at Gen Con. We'll probably have a fact for that game within a week.
We'll be handing it out as we go into the tournament. So,
but, I think it's helpful to reread the rule book, play the game a couple of times, you know, and then go back and reread it, because I bet stuff will jump out at you that you didn't pick up the first time, or certainly just always ask. But again, the golden rule for me, when in doubt, pick the option that makes the game more difficult, and odds are that will be the correct interpretation of the rules.
Well, this has been episode 12 of the Great Company Podcast. As always, thank you all for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode preceding Gen Con. And Dan, would you please tell the people where they can find us between the two episodes?
So we've got the blog on WordPress, greatcompanypodcast.wordpress.com. Email is thegreatcompanypodcast@gmail.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Next episode, we're going to be looking at the tactics sphere.
Woo-hoo. Everybody's favorite. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Night. We'll be right back.
Dang it.